Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Up Hollywood, Eddie Pence.
What's going on
in the house?
Hello.
No vacations?
No, I'm here this week.
How was your vacation?
I went to go visit my in-laws. So is that really a vacation?
I
had to paint the bathroom.
Oh,
is that really
that's
a vacation?
Not a vacation
no,
at all.
It's not a vacation.
Well, did you have fun at least a little bit?
Not much. Painted the bathroom. Much.
Yeah, that's so. Sucks. Did you like paint a mural or was it just like,
no, just yellow?
Painted. Oh,
just the color yellow. Semi gloss.
Nice.
So I got to perform. I did a couple of shows when I was up there. So,
oh, that's other cool. That, where did you perform?
The Throckmorton Theater in Mill Valley.
Okay.
Very cool theater.
Nice.
So.
Nicely done, Eddie.
Robin Williams used to pop in there all the time.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
He's one of the special ones. We like him.
Yeah. So it's really great. It's like this little theater in this little like uber rich white old liberal.
Wait, what's the name of the club?
It's not a club. It's a theater. It's Throckmorton Theater. It's just this, in this little town of
Mill Valley. Yeah. I played at a club. I think it's called Sweetwater.
I don't know.
I think it's maybe right next.
It's probably right. It's not very big.
Yeah,
I mean, the place
small
is tiny.
Little drag, right?
It's
yeah.
The Throckmorton Theater. It's just like they have all this money and they just throw it into the arts, and it's just like.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So was there a good turnout?
There, yeah. I mean, it's like a, you know, it's got an upper deck, but I mean, no one was on the. Than the balcony, but like the bottom was full, and some nights are packed there. It's every Tuesday they do comedy, and
you know what my memory of Mill Valley is? Playing at this club called Sweetwater. We're not even 5 minutes into the set. We're playing. Sound guy goes out to go smoke a joint, and like somebody was like, "Dude, I need more of this. I need more of that." And I'm like, "Is the sound guy in the house? Is the sound guy?" I'm like, "Jerry, are you in the house?" And then he just comes running back. "Sorry, man. I thought you're all set up." I'm like, "Dude, you couldn't wait 10 minutes? Like, you can go do that 10 minutes into a set." But
did you get paid well at the gig?
No.
Really?
No. It was not like that. Those are old days.
You should play the Throckmorton.
Yeah,
they pay very well.
I will look into that. I like that. But we're going to jump right into, we have a special guest, Mr. Andrew Goldenhirsch, who's returning.
I didn't realize there was a studio audience. This is cool.
Oh, yes. We hide them.
Wow.
See, I've got some tricks up my sleeves, too.
These are well hidden. I'm fried, man.
Andrew is an extraordinary magician.
Thanks.
You have been performing for years. You've been winning awards. I just read on your bio today to just get like a recap. You're the only person that's won Parlor Magician and Close-Up Magician 12 years in a row? That's what it said? Something like that?
Kind of. Well, not quite. No, I've got a bunch of nominations is what happened.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, in fact, it was...
My bad.
No, don't worry. It's a complex thing to read. No, there was about 10 years where every year I was nominated Close-Up and Parlor. I did not win for 10
years.
Oh,
you're like, what's-her-face, that soap star?
Susan Lucci.
You're the Susan Lucci of magicians.
Exactly.
Like, damn it.
And then finally, 2 years in a row, I won in Parlor, which has been great.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it was a nice feeling. I still get quite a few nominations for the Close-Up Gallery. There's an awards coming up in a couple weeks. I've got another nomination.
Got the trick of tricks. Honestly, I've seen a lot of tricks. You're going to do this trick at our show. I already talked to...
If we're talking about the same thing,
yeah,
are we talking about at the end?
Yes.
Oh, cool.
Oh, yes.
All right.
And Eddie,
cool.
You're going to be impressed.
Yeah.
Make sure you catch this, especially his finale. It's just ridiculous. And I've seen it a couple times. It's a little bit of escapism. It's a little bit of, oh my God, how do you do that? It's a little bit of how the what? It's a little. It's just a little bit of wizardry. It's awesome.
All those
awesome
emotions that should be coming through when you see in magic.
Yeah. All the emotions that are written on Eddie's face right now.
Really?
I don't know. I'm just
giving you a blank face. Yeah. You're assigning what you want to it.
I kind of felt like you were going back to that yellow bathroom.
Yeah, I'm back in the yellow bathroom. Painted. Well, it wasn't yellow before I painted it.
What color was it before?
It's like a mud brown.
Look at you. Ooh. You're a magician too.
So it took like three coats
mud
to get that yellow over
top
of
it. Paints a bathroom mud.
Well, they just moved into it, so it was like the people there before did it. Like it was like this cave, this dark cave of a bathroom.
Well, the funny thing that you bring up the mud brown, the first time I saw Andrews at the Magic Castle for our friend Joe Nicky's birthday, who's been on the show before, he and I were roommates, and at the time we were roommates, we went and got paint. And I was like, what color are you going to paint your room? He said, chocolate chip.
That's Joe. That sounds like Joe.
He painted it poop brown.
Wow.
As his like home room decor color.
That sounds like Joe.
And he's painted several houses that same.
I would imagine, yeah.
Well, but somehow he makes it look good.
His ice cream truck is brown and light brown.
He loves brown.
He loves brown.
That's why we're friends, dude.
It's a real fine line between chocolate and poop, you know?
It's like close, neck and neck.
I've been saying that for years.
So, Andrew, you're going to also be host of our show.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm
pretty
looking
excited
forward to
that. About that.
Yeah.
I've never seen you do that.
Oh, like, it's a blast.
And you're going to be doing magic.
Yeah. You know, so at the Magic Castle, there's the Palace of Mystery, which is kind of the big room, and usually there's three acts and one MCs. So, yeah, back in the early days, I did some MCing there, other places. And, yeah, in the past few years, I'm finding myself doing more and more MC gigs. You know, a few rock shows, a few... There was a club, an old hangar, actually, one of Howard Hughes' old hangars. And unfortunately, it's going away for the new Silicon Beach. But, right. Yeah, but really cool club. We, hosted a 24-hour rock festival there.
Wow.
Which was pretty crazy.
24 hours?
24 hours. Like I didn't do the whole 24. But
you're like, I can only
split
do
split up
the
with
first
another
three.
Guy. Yeah. No, but really, really fun. You know, it's fun to be up there in front of people.
Well, the MC should be super. Like, that's one of the big issues in the comedy world is they always put the MC as the least experienced comic.
Right.
MCs a show.
Yeah.
And that's back in the old days, it was like the best comic MC'd the show.
Oh, wow.
It was their show.
Yeah.
And then other people came on and did it, and he carried the or she or whoever was the MC. It was their show. I mean,
yeah.
But now it's like, oh, this is the, I've been doing it for 2 years. Okay, you're going to MC. You do 5 minutes up top, then bring me up. I mean, that's.
Yeah. The guy that we get to pay the least.
Yeah.
And does the least amount of time, and the least amount of experience.
Yeah. But has to hang out backstage.
Has to hang out,
Right. Because you.
They just, that's just the way it is.
Jump out to the parking lot and smoke a joint.
So. Yeah. They used to, like, the MC used to be like the coveted position in the show. Yeah. It was like you were the, it was the master of ceremonies.
Yeah.
Well, we're now bringing that back.
Now it's just sort of like.
We're bringing that back.
No, I'm glad. It should be someone who carries the whole show. That's what a master
like
ceremony should
feeling.
Be.
You know, I've always enjoyed kind of being in that position. My feeling is you're kind of the inner voice of the audience, you know.
It's
you
a dying,
it's true.
Yeah, it doesn't. There's only a few comics that are really good at it anymore, and a few. I've never seen you host. I've never like. It's not something that's really cultivated anymore.
Yeah, it's definitely its own skill set.
Yeah,
there are some magicians back in the day who were known as being wonderful MCs or compeers, as they would call it. There was a guy named Terry Seabrook. He passed a few years back. He was best friends with a mentor of mine, the late Billy McComb, and they were both incredible MCs.
Like a great MC can make a mediocre show amazing,
exactly.
And a bad MC can ruin a great show.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
That's very true.
You know, so much of it, I really feel, is that commentary.
Yeah.
I mean, you are kind of the...
You're almost the audience's voice of the show.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
If something's going bad, call it out. If something's going great, you just ride the wave.
If something weird happens, talk about it.
Yeah,
have
exactly.
a moment.
Exactly.
You know? Yeah, yeah. You know, the alternative comedy world in this town definitely influenced the way that I looked at MCing.
Oh, really?
You know, I spent a lot of time. Well, yeah, I used to go to Comedy Death Ray.
I remember Comedy Death Ray
when it was called Comedy Death Ray. And you know, there's something special about the MCs there.
Yeah.
Well, part of it is just it's alternative comedy. You know, they are definitely in that practice of being in the moment, and being in the room, and calling out whatever's happening.
It's very meta.
When you say alternative comedy, what do you mean?
Well, like UCB. I mean, it was like, there's that
it's,
whole generation.
It's no longer alternative because they've kind of taken over.
Yeah. It depends on the way you look at it. I mean, there was that subset of comedians like the Patton Oswalt, Maria Bamford, like the Campbell, that was like technically quote unquote alternative comedy. But if you look back at them, it's just funny. I mean, there's like a sect that is alternative, and it's very like not even avant-garde. It's just sometimes people say, oh, they have no jokes, so they're alternative comedians. But like alternative comedian, like not if it's different. Funny, it's funny.
Yeah, I agree.
You know?
Yeah.
So
lots of ways.
So it's like improv? Yeah. Is that what you're saying?
No.
It's less that, you know what?
It's not set up punch. It's not. So it's not as jokey as some people think normal comedy is.
Here's a way of let me give you a little origin story, since these are big these days. So Uncabaret, which is now going on once again downtown, but way back when, I guess it was mid-90s, Luna Park and Beth Lapidus, who still curates this thing, she would basically invite her comedian friends onto this show where they were not going to do their acts. You know, she would give them like 20, 30-minute sets to just talk about what was going on in their world, in the world, in their lives, whatever. Julia Sweeney developed a lot of her stuff for her one-woman shows out of those shows. A lot of folks came up with great stuff just by, you know, not doing their prepared material and just kind of exploring their own comic voices.
Winging it. That's crazy.
Yeah, but like getting real and getting personal, and it inspired a lot of people. And now, a lot of the comedians that, you know, you see in, I guess you would say, the power positions out there in showbiz kind of came out of that tradition. And it's very personal stuff. And I think it's great. And but more importantly, it really influenced the way that I approach magic. I would, you know, go to all these shows, and there was something really visceral when you really felt that they were in the room with you. And, you know, magic is such a kind of in-the-moment thing. I really enjoyed kind of taking that on. And, you know, that's very much kind of against a lot of the traditions of magic. When you look back, because magicians tend to kind of be in control, and they like to run the room. And I just kind of always enjoy that slight chaos factor, you know? It just makes it seem of the moment.
Well, and when you're in an audience like that, there's definitely going to be some chaos.
Sure.
It's going to be a little bit of mixed match.
Exactly. But, you know, I feel like there's something really great about those comedy shows when you feel like I am sitting here tonight and I am seeing things with these people that, you know, will never be said again. And, you know, any time that you have unique experiences, you know, unique occurrences in a live performance venue, you know, that's a gift.
Right.
So, you know, trying to work that into magic where things are usually much more under control, that's been, I don't know, it's opened me up a lot.
That's awesome. How did you get into magic? I think we talked about this a long time ago.
We probably did,
We danced around it.
Yeah, you know, so many people have kind of the same stories. We got turned onto it, you know, when we were, you know, 7, 8 years old or something, getting a little set, trying out things. It was a side hobby, really, up through, you know, junior high school. But, you know, just in the background. Music was my main thing. I started piano when I was like 6 or 7.
I remember that.
Played, pretty seriously about 10 years or so. But
and you still play guitar.
I do, yeah. In college, I picked up classical guitar, and then got into the fingerstyle world, and I have not looked back. It's been really wonderful. The past 2.5 years or so, I actually dove back in pretty hardcore. So
that's good, because like
really
magic
fun.
Also has a rhythm. There's like time is so much of it. You know.
Oh my God! I just had a long conversation with a buddy of mine last night about this. In fact, rhythm in magic has been fascinating me lately. Off beats, non beats, stuff like that.
I think that's the one thing that unites music, comedy, and magic is the rhythm.
Yes.
I think I've been thinking about like why I like these three things so much, because they're so different, you know? Yeah. And in doing this showcase, you know, Eddie and I were talking about doing music and comedy for years. And he was like, I don't know if it'll work. And I'm like, but if you combine all three and you present it in a way, it'll work.
I mean, timing is everything.
And it's all in rhythm. Like all of us in our art forms love rhythm so much. You know what I mean? So
totally.
It's interesting to kind of think about how timing affects all three of our crafts in such different ways.
And there are quite a few magician musicians. They seem to be allied arts. I think they require a lot of the same discipline. They certainly require a lot of the same kind of level of self-study and self-direction. But, rhythm fascinates me in magic. It's something I've been paying a lot of attention to lately.
Has there ever been a trick where you were like, maybe I shouldn't do this. This is going to be harmful to me. Because there's always that, you know, like that David Blaine. David Blaine does stuff like that. There are magicians where it's like, dude, how do you do that? That's crazy.
I've ridden that line occasionally. I might do something a little on
risque,
the edge. For
right.
Yeah, I'm not sure if you've seen this piece, but there's a piece I do in the close-up gallery, which is, my gosh, I don't want to say too much. It's based on some East Indian traditions, basically, and involves small, sharp objects. But
you got like, Eddie intrigued.
But it's funny. Yeah, everyone kind of... I was also talking to a gentleman about David Blaine recently. And you know, the way that he loves riding that line between you know, magic and endurance stunts. And he really kind of likes keeping up that ambiguity of, you know, is this real or not? Which is very cool. For me, well... Okay, in early days, I used to street perform when I first moved to L.A.
What was your first spot, or what was your favorite spot?
Favorite spot? Universal City Walk.
Mm.
I worked with a buddy who is still out there, Fire Eater,
okay,
and Michael Morena. We were called Magic and Mayhem, and it was a blast, and we'd do City Walk, and my gosh, yeah, street performing. Man, do you learn a lot of performance chops when you're on the street? Because
I agree.
Yep, there, you learn every dead spot, you learn every hole in your work when your audience can walk away at any point. You know.
Yep.
You know, I think that's the
hardest thing. I've had to do that a lot with music too, and it's like, you really have to learn if you can hold an audience, even for 10 minutes, 15 minutes. If you have them for the whole time, it's rare that they'll stay for 45 minutes and just sit or stand. But if you can keep them even for 10 minutes and they're convinced to take a piece of you home with them, like a CD or a shirt, or it's like, then you know you've kind of done your thing. But those moments when you kind of gather people, and I know you went through that at Universal City Walk.
Oh, yeah.
Full of tourists, full of people that want, you know, experiences and opportunities like that.
Absolutely. You've just got to prove to them that, it's worth standing here rather than wandering off to look for the next thing.
Well, you know what? In reading your bio, you did like close up, you did parlor. Now you're doing street, and you've done theater stuff too. Do you have a favorite venue, or do you have a, or is it all kind of like a Rubik's cube?
It always tends to be. I mean, the reality of making a living as a professional magician is it really helps to be able to do a lot of different stuff. But what it comes down to is my roots are in close up magic. It was the close up stuff that really pulled me in. It was seeing guys doing the stuff that you couldn't buy in a magic shop that really kind of opened me. It opened me up. And again, that was about midway through college, so I would have been like early 20s. And, you know, at that point, I really dove in. When I started doing parlor stuff, when I started doing big stages, and that was mostly once I moved to L.A., I guess I found I maintain that kind of close-up aesthetic. I love the idea of walking on stage with nothing, you know, no big boxes or any of that. There are great grand illusionists out there who do, you know, the big productions, the big spectacles and all that. And it's great. I like the minimalism, you know.
Yes.
And you know, there is something very special about, you know, knowing that you're in front of like 500 people, and knowing that you have almost nothing on stage, and you know, just with your voice and your hands and whatever else happens, to be able to maintain them.
Those tend to be my favorite magicians. Do you see a lot of magic shows, Eddie?
No. I've been to Magic Castle twice.
Oh, cool.
Sometimes. I haven't seen a lot of... My son had, like, an interest in magic for a couple of years. When he was, like, six or seven, he kind of got into it. So I gave him a couple, like, summer camps. He went to some magic camps.
Great.
So I would go watch his show, but then they would have, like, a magician then struggle with that. So he would do a little bit during... So, last couple of years I've been watching a little bit, but not immersed. And it's mostly kid magic.
Gotcha.
You know, so...
Yeah. I mean, it's a vast world out there.
Yeah.
And by the way, to finish answering that question, you know, about dangerous stuff. before I moved to L.A., I actually did learn to eat fire. And that was one of the things that I did for quite a while. But, yeah, it only takes one accident to kind of make you rethink
a lot
of things.
Did you have an accident, like, on stage?
I did.
Wow.
I
really?
I did. Yep.
What happened, if you don't mind me I know those years are behind you, but
yeah,
this is the good
stuff. I could dive back. Yeah, this is the stuff that
the sizzle.
These are the inside stories.
Well, you can grow a beard, so
yeah. Actually, I did have a goatee. It probably helped.
Yeah. Oh, really?
I think it saved me in some ways. Well, you know, fire eating, there are, I guess, kind of two aspects of it. One is the eating itself, you know, putting fire into your mouth. The other are kind of the crazier tricks, things like blasts, as they're called, which is basically when you blow a giant fireball.
Right.
Yeah, pretty much about the coolest thing you can do and probably the most dangerous. So, yeah, growing up, I had played French horn. During those college days when I was minoring in music, I was taking vocal lessons also. So what I found during that, you know, with the combination of having the breath support and having studied embouchure and stuff, I was able to do very, very big blasts.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was very cool, and it was kind of a signature. But, yeah, it was just one show. The wind blew a little bit of mist of fuel onto my face, and that ignited.
God. And really?
Yep. Had to put it out with my hands, and yep. Fortunately, just, you know, some second-degree burns, nothing worse than that.
Jesus.
And,
I was like, okay,
this is no longer worth
it,
you know?
Right.
I mean, it put me out of commission for a few weeks. But, there are risks to things. I mean, just about anything that we do. And, yeah, you got to do calculated risks. So, yeah, you know, my buddy still eats fire, and, I mean, he's great at it. You know, there's crazy little tiny nuances that you wouldn't even imagine, like, you know. But again, most of this has to do with timing. But, yeah, fortunately, by that time, when I'd had the accident, I realized, you know what, I got plenty of other stuff. I can close with other things. And, yeah, I just realized I didn't want to take the risk.
I have a question just that I've always wondered. How did you come up with your closing trick? Without going into too much detail.
Yeah, it's a simple, I remember the moment. I was still living in St. Louis, Missouri. So this would have been, sometime in the mid-90s. I had been hanging out with a friend who, was a fellow magician who, I'm at his place and, you know, I look over at the door and there's a straitjacket hanging on a hanger on the wall. And I was like, is that what I think of it is? And he goes, yeah, you want to try it? It's like, okay. So he tied me up, and it took me like 20 minutes or something, and it was exhausting. But, that was my first experience getting out of a straitjacket.
And he didn't give you any hints or anything?
Yeah, he helped me a little with, talk me through things. But, just had me go through the experience of doing it on my own. So I became kind of intrigued by, the whole idea. I got one. I ordered one from this company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, called Humane Restraint, which is like one of the believe it or not. And one of the only companies in the U.S. that still actually produces legit straitjackets. And so then it became me engaging in inquiry that I try to do a lot, which is how can I make this unique to me?
Right.
What is my take on it?
Modify it.
Yeah. So I was playing with some ideas and, without getting into the specifics, let's just say I was in a bowling alley contemplating one of these, and I was at the snack bar having some nachos, and I was just brainstorming and, you know, trying to say, just come up with what do I have to say about this piece? How can I give it my twist? And I was thinking about all the different ways to make things challenging. And one of the items that occurred to me was a household grocery good.
Right.
And when that popped into my head, and then suddenly I saw where that could go, I got very excited. And I started in the process of trying to figure out how to make it happen.
It's such an extraordinary trick.
Thank you. I apologize to everyone being so cryptic about this.
No, but I mean, that's a little bit of the suspense. But the coolest thing is I've seen a lot of magic shows. And that's one of the most memorable tricks I've ever seen. And I've seen it multiple times, and it just becomes more fascinating the more I see it.
Wow.
And we have another magician who's going to be our guest next week.
Yes.
Siegfried Tieber.
Yeah.
He's the same way. He's close-up magic. It's a totally different style.
Very.
But I watched him again at the Magic Castle with you the other week.
Yep, yep.
And seeing some of his act again, it just made me even more fascinated. I was like, some of these tricks are just ridiculous. They're so good. And you both are just totally different styles in your magic, but very complementary in like how you present the idea of entertaining magic. You know what I mean?
Thanks.
It's awesome. It's awesome.
You know, I haven't known Siegfried for very long, but he is truly well, and he hasn't been around the castle for as long. I mean, he's been hanging out a few years. You know, I've been hanging out, over 20 years. But he is one of those just super memorable characters.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think something that he and I have in common, and we chat about this a little bit that day when we met to check out the venue. He and I are, I guess the simplest way of putting it is we are the same on stage as off. That's kind of always been my goal, and sort of the development of my character and all that is just to get real up there, which I think is also something that was heavily influenced by the alternative comedy world. You know, when you're playing a character, you got to have the training to do that well.
Right.
You know, we're in an actor's town, so I'm not a highly trained actor. You know, there's a lot of nuance that goes into that. When I'm
you're
myself,
like method magic,
in a way, You know, I mean, there's a lot of there's so much going on beneath the surface. When you think about it, there's so much that we have to kind of keep maintained in our heads, but silently. You know, this has kind of been a new area of fascination to me. It's just all the things you have to overcome as a magician. You know, we have all of this information in our heads. Something I've described. It's like being a magician. It's like being an attorney. Defending a guilty client, you know, there is something there, and the fact is we are aware of it, and they talk about this, and this may have even come up at the camps. There is a phrase referred to as magician's guilt, and this happens especially for kids.
I've never heard of this.
This is absolutely true. When you teach an 8-year-old to do a trick, they're like, they want to do it, and then they want to
tell you
the
how
secret.
It's done. Yeah.
They really do. Like that is a deep. It's a thing, and even for adults, it happens. It's bizarre, and it's just by nature of who we are, and, you know, we do have something to hide. Sometimes it's just information, but, I don't know. That push and pull is really fascinating.
You have the guilt of not telling the secret? Is that what you mean?
Kind of. It's more that it is an unusual thing to be standing in front of people.
You see someone in awe, you're like, you want to explain, like, no, this is how you do it. It's just the natural reaction. You're like, no, you like this. And you're like, but you can't.
Yeah.
Right.
In fact, you brought up something, another aspect of it, which is that moment of awe, that kind of moment of astonishment, it's an inherently uncomfortable moment. And there are a lot of tendencies in the magic world to kind of, you know, people want to almost step on that moment.
They
You know, because it can be powerful, you know, that moment of stunned silence. And so many guys want to throw in a joke or something like that. A guy who has been around the castle for a very long time, who you may have heard the name Max Maven, has used a phrase for a very long time, which is magicians are afraid of magic.
Wow.
And, it is a moment when you kind of, you have people in a very vulnerable state, and you are in a vulnerable state, and people aren't always used to being vulnerable like that.
Right.
You know, it's something that I think I've been kind of specifically trying to kind of stretch within myself, you know, and get more and more comfortable in that kind of sitting. And I think it's made a huge difference with just how I think about magic, how I interact with audiences. But, yeah, it is a deeply complicated thing, and a lot of the most complicated stuff is sort of going on in the background.
It's just absorbing that moment, just like taking that moment, like you've taken a whole room full of people and ripped any sort of reaction away from them to the point where they're just like, what happened? Like, and you just want to stop it because it's uncomfortable for you. It's like it's like in comedy, like you get like a big laugh or an applause break, and some comics just like rush into their next joke. I'm like, no, sit on that.
Yeah.
these people are having a reaction they can't control. Like, absolutely. Whether it's just all or laughing, yep, or applauding or cheering. Yep. Like,
and it's always multi-layered, too. Yeah. It'll go through spaces.
Yeah. So, and if you just hold for a second longer, it'll build.
Yeah.
But some people will just step on it.
Yeah.
And I mean, if you just if you let it go, you're saying that it'll
just give it an extra beat.
Right.
It usually evolves.
Right.
Because you're afraid, like, I don't know if magicians are, but you're just afraid of that. I think they're just afraid of that next moment. Like, what's happening after that next moment? Because I'm so uncomfortable in this one. Like, they don't want to just see. But it's like when you tell a joke and people are laughing, or even if it doesn't get the laugh right away, if you just hold for a second and it'll click with people, and they're like, oh my God, just like hold for a second.
Yeah. People tend to be in a hurry. Right. It is.
You're in a rush just to get through to the next one. I'm like, no, be in the moment.
It's like the equivalent of a comedian laughing at his own jokes, too, you know, because, it's a fear of getting the wrong reaction. So you want to, I think a lot of the time it's a control thing.
Yeah.
But like when you are willing to let back, to sit back and let it happen. You know, to me, like, the pauses are also so interesting.
Oh, I love the silence.
I mean, you go back to, I mean, of course, everyone, for years people talk about Jack Benny, but it's absolutely true. Like, you can get a whole other layer of things when, I mean, just, there are so many ad-libby situations that happen in magic, because, you often, you have people on stage, and there's all kinds of things that can go wrong. And, like, I have found so many times, like, I want to just, I want to throw a line. I want to get a comeback if they say something funny. But the power of, looking at them when they made that funny comment, and then, like, starting to say something, and then taking another moment to think a little deep. Like, you get all of this delicious, very rich laughter and stuff.
Well, because you're leaving that empty for other people in the audience to fill in what's in your head.
Like,
and so they become part of the show, and they're laughing because they're thinking that's what he's thinking, instead of actually saying it. And they're like, oh no,
right,
you're gonna get a laugh with your joke, but if you let the other people fill in that blank, it can take it to a whole other level.
And the beauty is that joke can still happen after all the other stuff has kind of played itself out.
Exactly.
But we keep coming back to timing, and we keep coming back to alternative comedy, but that very much influenced me. Oh, that's right. In fact, speaking of all these alternative comics, some of my favorite approaches within it, I mean, and one guy that keeps popping into mind is Andy Kindler.
Yeah.
Because, he will do a joke that, doesn't get quite the expected reaction, and then he goes back and deconstructs it and tells you why that didn't work.
Yeah.
And that stuff is usually, just as funny, if not funny.
Well, you're just watching the psychosis of Andy Kindler on stage.
That too. And there's something really cool about that. I mean, I think in some ways he inspired me early on to, to look at that. Because, like, so much of the time he's talking about how uncomfortable it is to be performing, and, like, the very nature of doing comedy for people.
That's true.
And, there's something sort of ridiculous about doing magic for people too. You're in this strange...
Why do you say that?
Well, because we're all sitting... I think you're sitting there as an audience. It's all adults, and there's an adult on stage, and you're like, you're all trying to, like... We know there's no such thing as real magic. Like,
exactly.
It's not... There's no superpower involved. It's, and we're all sitting there, and you're just waiting, and then you're still in awe of whatever the magician just did. So I just think there's that whole... Like, it's a level of absurdity.
Yes.
Because of what you're sitting there watching and what the person up there is trying to convince you that you just saw. It's just, I can see where that...
It's, we're adults.
Yeah.
We know it's not real. Okay, there's a wonderful man named Robert Neal, who's up in Vermont, and one of the greatest minds in magic when it comes to, really... I guess alternative thinking. And, he's a believer that this is, it's like it's an accepted contract between the performer and audience. We are entering a playland.
Yeah.
We are entering a land of make believe.
Well, because you're reducing your audience back down to children in a way, because you're doing something so abstract and something we all know is not real, but we're still like.
Yeah.
How did you do that?
And it's very different from that theatrical contract.
Yeah.
There isn't quite this... Well, the main distinction is suspension of disbelief.
Yeah.
Okay? When you're in a theater, you truly suspend disbelief. you ignore Peter Pan's, you know,
strings
and, or wires or whatever they're using these days.
You focus inside the proscenium arch, and you're like, okay, that's the reality I'm focused on.
Right. We are not asking for your suspension of disbelief.
And you're not given that either by the audience. The audience is not going in like suspending disbelief. They're going in critical.
If they did, it wouldn't be that cool.
No.
Right? They'd be like, yeah, of course you could do that. You know, so yeah, you. That's what's really fun to me. You are engaging the logical brain in kind of this almost a war with the creative mind. You know, and I'm in my head trying to decide how deep to go.
No, but go as deep as you can.
Yeah,
man.
Why not? There is a there is a wonderful man in Spain by the name of Juan Tamariz.
Siegfried's favorite magician.
Ah, there we go.
The guy who's written all the books.
Yeah.
Yeah.
One of those books is called The Magic Way. And it opens essentially with a metaphor that the mind of an audience member is like a cart. It's like a carriage being pulled by two horses. Hmm. There's a black horse with its blinders on that knows where it's going. That's the logical mind. And right next to it, on another set of reins, is a winged Pegasus. Hmm. You know, the creative imagination. magic. And in essence, the way that he structures his routines, the way that he kind of creates the experience, it's designed to engage yet wear out the black horse. You are sending it down down garden paths that are going to be false. You are sending it on little false routes. You are, and the whole time you are kind of engaging all of its possible options until finally it succumbs and lets Pegasus fly. And not only is that kind of a beautiful sort of metaphor that, you know, because in some ways that is what happens. There's that push and pull, and we're asking questions, and eventually when there are no answers left, you know, we're left free-flying. But the way of structuring it, the way of accepting the logical mind, and knowing that, you know, it's going to have objections, so why not go for it, and let's point at, and let's look at, and let's analyze it, and then by the end, it's like this has been completely picked apart. In many ways, it is like a lawyerly approach. You know, you address the counterarguments, and my God, he's able to create miracles, like sometimes with nothing but a deck of cards. But you are left with such utter impossibility that it's the only way you can go.
And have you seen him live?
Right? Oh, yeah. Many times.
Wow.
Many times. Yeah. And most of the time, it's in gatherings of magicians. Hmm. So there is nothing like seeing
you
this
have
man.
To, you have to let me know if he comes back.
Oh, yeah.
But and he performs in English?
Yeah.
Oh, I thought he mostly does Spanish.
Well, in Spain he does.
Okay.
But he's able to perform in English. And when he's come over here, it's sometimes been for these magic conventions, and there is nothing better than being a part of some group of magicians sitting around at like 3:30 in the morning with him, Juan, and a deck of cards just improvising.
That sounds so cool.
You see magicians' jaws dropping just around the circle. It's crazy.
That's awesome.
Because, you know, that approach of engaging logic and then breaking it is something he does for magicians, too.
Hmm.
Because he knows how we think, so he's able to take it to that extra level. You know, taking what we know and, I guess, essentially using it against
us. But you and Siegfried both, it's funny that you both mentioned him as a major influence, because you both are like that as magicians. And that's one of the reasons, you know, like when we were putting this whole thing together, I wanted you both so badly to be a part of this, because what you do for an audience, it's just beyond intriguing. It's beyond captivating. It like will leave you questioning things and talking about it after you leave. And that's one of the best parts of magic, is it becomes like this conversation that you just have by yourself when you leave. Like, how did he... But there was no, you know, and then you just sit there like, man. And I like that. It's kind of like a math problem that you can't figure out. It's like you can't compute
or
all
like
the things.
You're awesome, missing something. Like lateral thinking puzzles, you know, where you don't want to jump to the answer. You want to explore. Huh.
Interesting.
Yeah. It's funny that the attorney thing keeps coming up. I don't know if I mentioned this here. I might have mentioned it last year when we talked. But, when I was in college and kind of had these awakenings when I saw what magic really could do, I was studying political science, and I was on the law school path. So, yeah, that is where I was headed. I think I've always had that way of thinking. There's a lot of law in my family. My father's a judge. My grandfather was a judge. It's something I was brought up with. And, yeah, I really love the guys who address it in that way. A good attorney, you address all the potential counterarguments.
Right.
Speaking of attorneys, there's another guy on the East Coast named Darwin Ortiz who is also an attorney by trade and a wonderful magician, specifically, mostly focusing on close-up and specifically cards and gambling artifice and stuff like that. But, he actually wrote a book called Designing Miracles about structure. And, yeah, I've always felt for years like a great magic routine is structured like a great argument. You have to address the concerns and confront them head on.
How does that change the way you present when it's close up versus doing something?
It's really
theatrical.
Great close up because you are right there in front of people. Mm-hmm. And I find that a lot of the time kind of underneath, it's like the underlying conversation beneath my close up performance, especially in a really intimate setting, like truly one-on-one, is almost, okay, guys, you're adults. We know this isn't real. Let me kind of address that little inner voice, that's talking right now. And, there's something beautiful when you are really close up. You're able to really get into the details. You're able to eliminate all possibilities, sometimes even before you actually do the magic. And there's something really pure about that.
Well, there's always like a guy like me that's going to be like, okay, I'm going to watch his right hand and his left hand the entire time.
Right,
and
right.
I'm going to watch those cards. And when you do that, it almost makes the trick even better when they pull it off. So you're expecting that kind of
more
audience.
Than expecting. Like one of my favorite things to do when I'm just in a situation with small groups in a very casual setting is something where at the beginning I am saying things like maybe you're thinking one hand is good, so it's all about making sure both hands are going to be in full view the whole time and just setting those conditions aside at the beginning. This is another thing that Juan does all the time. And, plus he's such a crazy character that even though you're technically doing logistics, it doesn't matter. It's still entertaining. It's still fun because he's being him, I think maybe that's, I think the reason why magicians often go through such a long period of kind of finding themselves as performers, like as a very separate track from as magicians, is because, the magic itself, there is so, just studying magic and sleight of hand, completely ignoring performance, you could spend a lifetime, in that study.
Right.
It requires something different, to really take, a holistic approach, really. Yeah, my gosh, you've got my brain going on a lot of things, but, it really is a kind of an alternate track. I mean, it requires a completely different way of thinking. There's us dealing with the construction, there's us dealing with our technique, dealing with sleight of hand, dealing with secret stuff, making that invisible, working on ourselves so that we can be relaxed and not thinking about when we're doing these things. That's the inner world of sleight of hand. The outer world of presenting sleight of hand is, how can every step of this be something interesting? And what I have found is that when you are engaging that logical mind directly, you're having a real conversation. So now it's not just about me setting, this is not just procedure. This is an interactive thing. I am taking you to the place that you have absolute conviction, and you're going there with me. You know, just but there's eliminating also that, possibilities.
And I know you're aware of this, but there's also that silent conversation.
Yes.
That I think spectator and magician have.
Yes.
With it's just imaginations. It's like, let me take your imagination through, you know, through the jungle, through this fantasy land.
Yeah.
And see if you're a believer at the end of it. And that's a lot of it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that's the part that almost convinces you, like, how do you do that? That's amazing. Yeah. That is magic. You know
right.
what I mean? So it's like,
right.
that's...
You are not just standing there expecting everyone to accept
right.
what's
right.
going on. It's so funny. The evolution of the character of a magician has, you know, really shifted over the years. And when you look at the old posters and stuff, you know, those guys are in control. You know, they're standing at the center of the stage and their arm is extended and things are flying around or whatever it is. But they are at the center of the action. They are the source of the action. And that's, yeah, that's just what you feel looking at all those posters. Things have shifted. You know, Doug Henning, who I used to watch back in the 70s, he, you know, it was about the wonder, and the magic was kind of happening to him, and he kind of wanted to share it with you. You know, Copperfield took a very different kind of control. He was very much in control, but almost in a more, like, aesthetic way, in addition, you know, which brings you into a new level. Plus, he also has that level of perfectionism that, yeah, he wants to engage the smartest people in the audience and make sure they're fooled too.
Right.
So, yeah, you have to get into those deeper levels. And, yeah, it's a very way of thinking. I mean, it's a very different way of thinking than the way that we think for the rest of it, for the construction. We really have to put ourselves in another head and, yeah, make sure that every step of this experience is going to be something intriguing. So, like, it's crazy how much entertainment, for example, Juan Tamarit is able to get out of, you know, a card trick. But it's because you are psychologically engaged at every moment.
Hmm.
You know, it just becomes a microcosm.
See that, Eddie? Mm-hmm. It's inspiring us to be magicians. Mm-hmm. So Colton took, he went to a class?
Oh, it's like a summer camp, like
and
a week
cool.
long
How
summer
many tricks did he learn?
Oh, he had the one where he had like a die and a little thing, and you'd shake it, and they would turn into four small dice.
Cool.
You know.
Yep.
And then he immediately told me how he did it.
Right.
Okay. You're like, oh.
He immediately took the trick apart, like, this is how right. you do it, Daddy, look.
Yeah. Yeah. It's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yeah. Plus, yeah. we find ourselves getting intrigued by these little
yeah.
things. It's like, you know, this method, is the methodology is so ingenious. Yeah, you
yeah.
want to share it with people.
Especially a little kid. It's just like when they figure
exactly.
something out, they want to explain it.
Right.
You know.
Yeah.
Well, the coolest thing about magic, I think, is it's simple concepts. The
yeah.
best tricks are the simplest concepts.
Yeah.
And when you can take something that has been almost kind of carried down generation after generation, it's the same trick, but it's modified, it's modernized, that's when it just reaches a new level. And it's like, my favorite magicians are, you know, the ones that kind of dissect their own trick and say, Houdini would do this.
Right.
And so-and-so would do this.
Exactly.
And they would go down this, and they're like,
yeah.
but this is what we're going to do. We're going to make it a little bit more dangerous,
yep.
a little bit more,
yeah.
like, you know, transparent.
Mm-hmm.
The transparency tricks are the ones that just baffle me the most, which is why your trick is, I mean, it's surprisingly pretty transparent, considering the element
yeah.
is not transparent at all.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So...
Yeah.
But that's what's so fascinating.
Yeah.
Like taking those small kind of concepts and making them larger than life.
Yeah. And what really fascinates me is, yeah, how can you consistently get people into that particular headspace that you are describing? And that's what really intrigues me. Because, yeah, when you really look at it, most of the time, these are simple concepts. And, you know, often the best, I mean, this is something that's been said for years, but, you know, the best tricks you could describe in a sentence. And I'm really, yeah, I've found lately, as I've kind of looked back over things, I really love the idea of taking something classic, you know, something that's really lasted through the ages, looking at why, and looking at what is something that could be done to make this, you know, a more modern statement.
Right.
Whatever it is, whether it's personalizing it, whether it's taking out an element that that has changed, whether it's adding in something new, whatever it might be. But I think for a lot of us, you know, that's kind of the ultimate goal. You know, for many of us, we got into magic in the first place because we saw something really classic. And most of the time, it's something very simple. It's something you can describe in a sentence. And it's a very visceral feeling, you know? So I guess we're kind of chasing the dragon in a way, you know, and trying to get that back. But, you know, to go back to roots, to go, I think this is no different from any art. You know, you experiment, you push things, but most of the time it comes back to taking these universal concepts and, you know,
sculpting a little bit.
Yeah.
That's the one thing that I find intriguing about all of the, like, the reason that the Federal, you know, we're doing this show Saturday, April 28th, 8 p.m. at the Federal Bar in North Hollywood. And the Federal said, you know, what would you like to do? What would make this exciting for you to do a show here? And I'm like, honestly, if it's just music, that's just boring. Like, that's just not exciting to me. I love music. Music's already exciting enough. But to do a show with music and comedy and music and magic, you know, to use those elements, I didn't mean to use music twice, but music, comedy, and magic all swirled together.
It's going to be a lot of music.
Those are my favorite things to, like, do when I go out.
Yeah,
like, I like to go to comedy clubs.
Yep.
I like to go to magic shows.
Yep.
And there's something about the three of those where it's intriguing to the eyes, the ears, the heart, the soul, the mind, the imagination, and it makes me excited that you're a part of this. So, Andrew, I'm so pumped that you're going to be a part of this.
Me too.
Saturday, April 28th, 8 p.m. at the Federal. You have some other shows or anything that you want to announce that you're doing?
Let's see. Well, I'm starting at the Magic Castle in a few days.
You got to run like club, this weekend, right?
This weekend, Thursday through Sunday.
Thursday through Sunday.
Yeah.
I'm going to try and make it out.
So, all of you listeners that have an in to the Magic Castle, if you've got a special friend somewhere,
you need call that, in a you favor. You need to know a magician.
Yeah.
See, Eddie, I'm hooking it up for you right now.
Thank you.
Bring Colton to the brunch.
They don't let kids in.
On the brunch, they can.
Oh, the brunch one, right?
They don't like
kids. Well, I know. I didn't say like. Let. They don't let kids in.
It's true. Yeah, 21 over.
Yeah, 21 and over.
During the evening.
But brunch, you can bring underage.
Yeah,
are you doing the brunch on Sunday?
No.
No, you just do Sunday
just doing the evenings. Just doing the evenings.
Never mind. I tried it. But Saturday, April 28th. 8 p.m. You will be hosting and doing your magic.
Absolutely.
And we're so excited about it. Yeah. Andrew, I know you did a long road trip, and I'm so stoked that you did tonight because it was a perfect fit. Siegfried's next week.
Yeah.
Have the magicians back-to-back just talking about what they do.
Yeah.
I'm very excited, and thank you for being a part of this.
Thank you.
And we're going to bring you back because you're always doing intriguing stuff. And
it's always good to chat with you.
You are the best, man. You are the best.
Brother.
Andrew Golden Hirsch. Eddie Pence, NK Band, Saturday, April 28th, 8 p.m. See Andrew at the Magic Castle this weekend, Thursday to Sunday. Are you there all night?
Yes, I'm in the Peller Theater with my buddy Albie Selznick. We are doing a 45-minute show together.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, I'll have to come out to that.
Yeah.
There's I'll have to text you and tell you what day I can
come. You'll see some things that you haven't seen before. It's a theater in the castle where each week they take two magicians and put them together. So,
that's awesome.
Yeah, so it's always fun to come up with, you know, things that we can do
together. I just love any excuse to go to the Magic Castle. I'm always super down.
It's a blast.
Well, hopefully I'll see you this weekend, but I'll definitely see you in 2 weeks.
Cool.
Andrew Golden Hirsch, and you have a website, magichands.com.
Goldenhands.
Goldenhands.com. I'm sorry. Golden
yes. It is going to be going through a big web overhaul. But,
okay.
You know, as websites tend to go.
Right.
But yeah.
Goldenhands.com.
Yeah.
Check him out at the Magic Castle this weekend and at the Federal with Eddie and myself. On behalf of Eddie and myself,
good night.
Good night.